3 minutes just to
get in the groove.
Bring everybody together.
All right, hold on. Whenever you're ready, Jay. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Morning. Happy Easter Sunday to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming. We're going to have a topic today. Is my sponsees are nuts? Then we're going to have a little interlude and then some questions and answers. So my name's Matthew. I'm an alcoholic. So I wanted to touch on a couple things about this. This is a broad topic, so we can say whatever we want, I think. And we were talking last night, you know, about the how do we convey the urgency of doing this work. And what the ripple effect it'll have in your life and in other people's lives. But then we were just talking about it Sunday morning and Easter Sunday, so you guys are the faithful. We don't really need to convey this to you. But I'm going to talk about my experience, and I'm going to talk about one of my sponsees named Sean.
Tell us about the guy that threw the big book at you.
Well, that's a good short story. I'll start. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is how I got into the AA Hall of Fame. I was sponsoring this guy in Santa Monica. And in Santa Monica, there's a meeting, a men's meeting at a restaurant on the 3rd Street Promenade, which is a pretty nice area, kind of a touristy area. And this guy had a shop. He had a head shop there. And he was struggling to get sober, but he would meet me and read, but he would never take any direction. So one day we're walking, and he's all anxiety-ridden and freaking out, and we're walking side by side with our big books. We're going to go sit. There's a bluff with some chairs where you can sit and look over Pacific Coast Highways down a cliff and then the ocean, the Pacific Ocean. So we're going to sit there and read, and I'm sort of walking a few steps ahead of him, and he goes, I don't understand why my life's not changing. I don't get it. I'm coming to all the meetings, and I'm meeting with you, and I go, well, gee, I know why your life's not changing. You haven't done a single thing I've asked you to do. You haven't followed any direction or taken any steps. And I turn around, and the book's going right at my head. So I duck, and it goes over the cliff on the Pacific Coast Highway. I would love to think some drunken guy in a convertible had it land there. But I would be embellishing the story if I made that part up. So
he called me and told me that, and I went, the guy threw the book at you, man?
Well, that was the best part. I called Bill, and I go, dude, do I have to sponsor this guy? I mean, he tried to hurt me. And he's like, no, I think you're good. And he's laughing. He threw the book at you, and he threw it hard. I mean, he meant to hurt me. And he went his way, and I went mine. And I walk all the way around talking to Bill on the phone. I go down the 3rd Street Promenade. I walk up in front of the meeting, and he's standing there and goes, thank you for never giving up on me. And I'm like, damn it! You know, I was this close to being free of you. But I will tell you, when Philippa was in the hospital, which was just a few months after that, he showed up all the time. And that was almost an hour drive for him, and he would sneak his dog in there to play with her and into ICU, and, you know, his heart was in the right place. He just, you know, he had a head shop. He was maybe the right job for a... So there was this guy, very charismatic guy, that used to come around and then tell this story and then tell you what I'm doing now with sponsorship. And I really was attracted to him. He's a great B3 organ player, interesting guy, tall Irish guy, and just full of life and creativity, but you couldn't trust him at all. He was one of those guys, you know, just very attractive personality. But he was going in and out, and he had done many years in prison as a bank robber. In fact, I think he robbed 33 banks. And Bill insulted him one time and said, "So you're an unsuccessful bank robber." And he said, "Hey, I was successful 32 times." You know? It's the last bank that gets you. But so I just loved him, but I didn't sponsor him. I liked seeing him. And one day he was sitting outside of a meeting in his old Mercedes. He's kind of he had big shotism, you know. He had this Mercedes. It would have been cool if it were like 20 years ago, but it was a mess, this car. And I go in and I get in his car and sit down, and it's full of pot smoke. And I said, "Sean, did you do a fifth step recently with Dean?" I think Dean Thomas was a sponsor. And he said, "Yeah." And I go, "What did you leave off?" And he goes, "How'd you know I left something off my fifth step?" And I go, "Well, I can smell it." You know? And I go, "Come on in the meeting." And I got out of the car and he drove away. And he disappeared for a while. And we had been friends for maybe over a year then, and he disappeared, and I was really worried about him. And then I get a call, and my wife is standing in the kitchen with this tiny kitchen. She's cooking, and the phone rings, and I pick it up, and it says, no, I get a call before that, about 2 weeks before that, and he says, "Hey, it's Sean." And I said, "What's up?" And he goes, "Man, I'll do anything to stop drinking. I'll do anything to stop drinking. I'm stuck here in Ohio." He'd gone on a Geographic, and he goes, "I'm in a hotel, and I got to stop. I'll do whatever you say. Will you sponsor me?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "You know, I think I can get you a bed at a sober living house." And immediately, he changed. He said, "Well, I'll give you a call in a week or so." And I go, no, and it clicked, right? So 2 weeks after that, my wife's cooking, and I'm standing talking to her after work, and the phone rings, and it's a collect call from the Green River, Wyoming jail, from Sean. "Will you accept the charges?" And just to find out the story, I'm going to accept the charges. Yeah, it's worth it.
It's always interesting.
Yeah, so I accept the charges. And he says, "I can't believe I'm this stupid." First thing out of his mouth. He said that about 5 times during the conversation. And I said, "Well, what happened?" And he's forgetting that he's on a phone from the jail. So they're probably recording him. And he said, "Well, I didn't want to stay in sober living, so I found these guys that would pay me to transport 180 pounds of pot from Ohio to California." So that was his plan. I'd get a bunch of money, I'd rent an apartment, and I'd get sober. But the wrinkle in his plan was he was nodding off on morphine, I think, and he got a flat tire outside of Green River, Wyoming, and he got out of his car, and he had a camel's hair coat on. So rather than change the tire himself, he called a tow truck. Well, guess what was on top of the spare tire? 180 pounds of pot, which he had forgotten about. So they looked in the trunk and go, "We need to tow your car." And he goes, "Okay." So they tow the car to the gas station. He goes into the office and he said, "It took forever to change my tire." He said, "I walk out, my car's up on the hydraulics, and the whole gas station's surrounded by police cars." Yeah. Now, this is a guy who spent a long time in prison. He doesn't want to go back. It's funny, but it's tragic. He's in his 50s now. He had a chance. So he goes to jail. And I get off the phone. This is the great part of the story. I said to my wife, she goes, "What did he keep saying to you?" I said, "He kept saying, 'I can't believe I'm this stupid.'" And she said, "That's so funny. You've been telling him he's that stupid for a year." I loved it. I actually told him that later, but he was in jail and waiting trial, and he called me and said, "Can you help me? I want to get out on bail." So I did. I arranged some things to help him, and I got him, and he came to California while he was waiting for his trial, and he did a fifth step. And I'll tell you, and I've heard a lot of them. And he came to my office. He's a great big guy. At night, I had an office near the airport. I was in shipping then. And he lit a cigarette, and there's no smoking in my office, but he was just so upset that I knew I couldn't stop him. And then he put his cigarette on my desk and lit another one. And I go, "Dude, you can't smoke in here, but if you're going to smoke in here, just smoke one cigarette at a time." But that's how nervous he was. And then he said, "I'm going to tell you everything." And he did. You know, he'd been to prison a lot. He'd done a lot of things, and he let it all out. And he was like crying from his guts, you know. And he was this great big guy. And there's moments in sponsorship where you say something and you don't know why you said it. You didn't plan on saying it. If you watch Bill Jay and I, we're thinking of what we're going to say, right? That's called AA listening. When you're talking, I'm going, okay, he's going to stop soon, and then I can say stuff. And it wasn't like that. I was just listening, right? And he went on for hours. And by the time he was done, he was curled up in a little ball on this couch in my office, and he was tiny. You know, this guy is 6'3", easily.
Yeah, he's a big guy.
And he's crying, and he says, and I don't know why I said this. I believe I was a channel. And I said, do you think, because of all these things you just told me, that God can't love you? And he's just wrenching. And he said, how could God, any kind of God, love me after all of that? And then again, out of my mouth, something I didn't plan on saying, I said, well, all I know is I'm sitting here, and I'm a human being, and I just heard all this, and I love you more than I've ever loved you. And I don't know why that happened, why that came out of my mouth. And I flew back to Green River with Sean for a pretrial hearing, and he was honest. You know, the judge asked me, is he going to drink again? And I said, I don't know. But I don't know if I'm going to drink again. But I know that when he's not drinking, he's a force in society. He's a good force. And he was supposed to get 15 to 20 years. He got 3 to 5. And he had the first ever, and in prison, he went to the Native Americans, big tall guy, right? And he said, look, you guys should come to AA. You're all drunk all the time here. You should come to AA. It really works. And they said, okay, white boy, you come to our religion, and we'll come to your religion. So this giant Irish guy had to sit through sweat lodges. And he said, Matthew, I thought I was going to die. And he tells me this later, but I used to see, he'd call me on the phone. One time he called me, and he goes, well, what's going on? And I go, well, have you got a minute? And he goes, yeah, I've got 5 years. So just shoot. And then I used to make him pray with me, and he told me later, he goes, that he used to get so much crap because he'd be kneeling on the prison floor with the phone barely reaching his ear. And he just was willing, you know. And never in the history of this prison did this happen, but the warden and the judge got together and got him out in a year. And he came to our seething cauldron and was a contributing member of our meeting. So obviously that's a wonderful thing to talk about, what happened in Sean's life, but I can't tell you how much he did for me. I put my house up to get him out of prison. Don't tell my wife.
She doesn't know?
No. It seemed like a detail that would just upset her.
I thought that's how she got the stroke.
But because I sensed, you know, there's a compliance and surrender.
Yeah.
And I could hear surrender. And I don't think I wasn't nervous about that. I was nervous about that. But the point of the story is how much I got. Like, why did I say those things about God to him? When I went back out in my parking lot that night after that fifth step, it looked smaller. You know, like when you go back to your old school and you're like, wow, the desks are so small and this was such a big place. He changed me. And we had a very loving friendship. I don't know where he is now. He's a rascal,
yeah.
But for a long time, he did a lot of good work and helped a lot of people. But anyway, I'll just finish with this. You know, I very rarely, when I get to talk at meetings, get up to what it's like now, you know, because there's a lot of stuff that happened. But what it's like now is 2 years ago, I moved to Washington from Southern California. And it was scary and painful because we had a great life in Southern California. But I'm the sole breadwinner because of my wife's disability. And I've been with the company a long time. And they were going through a downsizing. And they said, we can offer you this promotion, but you have to move. And, you know, I had two teenagers who were surfers and had great friends and lived in the sunshine. You know, Rory, who's sitting up there, used to throw his backpack in the door at 2:30. And then I didn't see him till dinner. He'd take off on his skateboard or take his surfboard with his friends. And we had a great life. And I had all these guys. You know, I had my home group and lots of service work. But we moved to Seattle. And it was really upsetting. You know, I didn't sleep for months. I'd go to sleep at 2, 3 in the morning up there in this new beautiful house we bought. And I'd wake up too early and I'd wonder, what have I done? What have I done? You know, and I did a couple things up there that were really important. And I want to share them with you. One is I built a cabin in the back of my property. I have 5 acres because when you sell a tiny little box in Los Angeles, you can buy a mansion in Washington. So I sold my box and I bought 5 acres. I have a pond and a beautiful house. But, you know, I wake up in darkness. I wake up with heaviness. I wake up like an elephant sitting on my chest like, what did you do? Is this about you? Is this really about you or is it about taking care of your family? And I can tell you, I don't know. I just made the best decision I could make as an adult because I have to support these people. You know, it isn't like I was dying to move to the Pacific Northwest. But I built this cabin, and because of some things Jay started with me where he was worried because I told him I wasn't meditating much years ago on the road. So he would call me every day, wherever I was, at 6 a.m, we'd meditate for 5 minutes. Well, that blossomed into a community, and I meditate for half an hour now from 5:30 to 6 with 4 or 5 of my sponsees, depending on who shows up, on a conference call. So I built this cabin. It's at the way at the back of my property. In the morning, I get up at 5. I walk back there. I read some spiritual literature, actually the same thing every day, but it's a big, long book. And then I light the candles, and I call the boys, and I sit still for half an hour. And sometimes I go deeply into meditation, and sometimes I just sit still for half an hour. But it's never not worth it, you know. And believe me, it's 30 degrees sometimes when I walk back there. I didn't know that oil in an oil lamp could freeze. Do you guys know that? It can. Which makes the oil lamp useless. And there's no electricity out there. There's just a wood stove. But I can tell you now, I don't know what I would do if I didn't do that. Because it's a big burden, and I had to learn that it's not all, you know, don't worry, like, make sure they're okay, do everything you can, plan some good vacations. And my wife, yeah, I was really worried when I moved up there that she would not be okay because she has inhibition because of her issues, and we're kind of out in the country, we're a little far from town, and, you know, you talk about things unfolding, consciousness unfolding. Bill would call them coincidences, I call them consciousness unfolding, right? God, is that I went to the soccer tryouts with my daughter. I flew her up there because I thought maybe I can get her on a soccer team. She'll make some friends. And the coach is from Ireland. And I said, oh, my wife's from Wales. And he kind of whipped around. He goes, your wife's from Wales. Where do you live? And I said, well, we bought the house on Spruce. And he goes, I know that house. And a couple of weeks after we moved there, 3 or 4 cars pulled up with 10 women from Ireland, Scotland, Wales, all of Great Britain. And my wife has more friends than she's ever had in her life. The other thing I did is I started going to meetings up there, and it's weird. No one wants the new guy from California to sponsor them. In fact, they don't really want him to share that much either because I share about the steps and stuff. And I had a hard time finding meetings where I felt like they were even being respectful to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went on a speaking thing to Colorado one time, and my host said, we're not going to go to the speaker's breakfast this morning. And I was feeling this emptiness and this disconnection when I lived in Washington. He said, we're going to go to the Salvation Army men's home because they need you more than you need to go to that breakfast. And I said, oh, that sounds great. And it was a big old craftsman house, and I went in there, and these guys were like leaning over like, what do you think this means on page 63? And how did you do this? And do you pay all the money back? Or what if you did something and nobody knew about it? And I just felt alive, you know, because I had all this experience and no one to tell it to. And I wanted that lifeline, you know, I wanted to feel my growth, and like Sean gave me and all those people gave me. So I go, this is what I'm not doing in Washington. So I go back to Washington and they go, I said, hey, is there any panels or Salvation Army things? And they go, oh, we have a prison panel. We could really use your help. And I go, okay. So I filled out all the paperwork, and they go, yeah, it's the women's prison right over there. And it's been an adventure, man. You know, I go in there, try to go once a month. Sometimes I'm traveling, and there's some people in there really working the program. I was really moved in there. There was a girl who said to me, you know, I was involved in this crime. And then she paused and said, you know, I really want to stay sober. I brutally murdered a man. I don't want to keep lying about what happened. I wasn't involved in a crime. I brutally and intentionally murdered a man. And she's doing great. She's sponsoring people. But then when we were moving up there, before we got there, Rory and I took the Airstream trailer up the coast. And my wife and daughter, who no one wants to move, right? My wife was more game because she likes adventure. But my daughter didn't want to move. She was 14. And they go to this house, and I purposely didn't set the alarm because my wife gets confused really easily, and I didn't want her to have the police come right when she got there, and the house was only going to be empty for about a week. Well, someone burglarized our house before we got there, and they stole everything. They stole the speakers out of the ceiling and the new computer I bought and some of the furniture and the beds that I bought. Weird. And you know that guitar that introduced me to my wife at the bus stop? They stole that. And I had hidden it in a crawl space in the top floor, thinking, because I'm paranoid about guitars, and they found it. Rory just reminded me, I bought a pack of cigarettes because I was flying up there for months at a time, painting bedrooms and moving furniture and buying computers. None of our personal stuff was there but this guitar. So I brought the guitar and I bought a pack of cigarettes, and I smoked like two of them in 3 months. And I stuck it up in this little drawer in the laundry room, that back pack of cigarettes. They stole the pack of cigarettes. They were in there for maybe days. So then I'm doing this prison work, and they said, hey, maybe you should, you've been showing up for the prison, and we can't get anyone to go to the county jail. And I go, well, I'm getting a lot out of this prison work. And I want to tell you, almost every time I go, oh, crap, I'm supposed to go to the prison, I don't want to go. Right. I like home. I like my guitars and my wife and my children and my dogs. But I go, and I float home. I float home, and it's different every time. So I get to the county jail, and it's darker. It's more grim than the prison, quite frankly. Those guys are in for a year or less. Some are waiting for sentencing. Most of them have lived there most of their lives. They're in and out and in and out and in and out. And I go, and there's a big panel of cells up here and a big panel of cells down here, and the guards are outside looking at me through glass, but they can't see them. There's mirrors. And I knew from my training that I need to control this. There's going to be more of them than me. And when they come out, I just run up to the stairs and I shake their hands and go, hey, I'm Matthew, I'm from AA, what's your name? And they tell me their name. I go, hey, if you're really serious about recovery, we really welcome you. If you're not, you can sit in your cell and keep the door open, that's fine, but we want to make sure you're serious. I try to set the tone, and it goes well. These guys, they have my back, you know. And then they let the bottom out. This all happens. And I go back home and thank God, you know, I think I'm connecting finally. I've been going for months. I think I'm reaching them. And on my desk is a letter from the Kitsap Corrections Department. And it says, I think, oh, maybe my badge is revoked or something. I can't go. Maybe they did something, background check. And I open it up, and it says, you know, the guy who burglarized your house is being housed in the Kitsap County Jail. So I'm 12-stepping the guy. And I meet 250 guys a week. I don't remember his name. I didn't look at his name. And I called Bill and said, I don't think I should look at his name, you know. So if I go in there, and I think all of you will have a chance to stay sober, but not you, you puke. But I would like to know where my guitar is. But I'm getting so much out of going there that I don't want to think about that. You know, I'm now connected to AA, although still hardly anybody knows me at the meetings. And one funny thing, I'll finish with this, is when I started at the prison, these women said, hey, we're trying to organize a conference. And I go, great. I have a lot of experience with conferences. So I helped them organize this conference. And a week before the conference, the speaker canceled. And they said, oh, they called me. And they said, our speaker canceled. And I said, you know, I've spoken at a couple of conferences. And they go, yeah, Matthew, we want a real speaker. So I didn't speak at the conference. But the point of all this is, with that house, with my family, and the love we have, and this service work, I don't have an elephant on my chest anymore, and I sleep pretty well. And I know that it isn't all about me. A friend of mine his sister was a third grade teacher, and the kid wrote a poem, and I think this is so beautiful about AA. His third grader said, I'm very small, I'm very small. I'm very small, but I'm part of it all. And that's where I feel like I finally found my place. So thanks.
He started speaking a lot, and he starts getting calls, you know. I mean, he's traveling around doing all this stuff, and so him and I both got called to do the Arizona State Convention. And I look on the schedule, and I'm the Friday night guy, and he's the Saturday night guy. So I call him up, and I go, did you tell them that they made a mistake? He said, no, it never crossed my mind. We had fun that week.
Yeah, it was a good one.
All sponsees are crazy. We're all a little bit nutty. Some of us have a little bit better social skills than others. I've run into guys that have virtually no social skills at all. For a long time, I sponsored this guy, Owen. Owen is a very strange man.
Follow me?
And the way he got out of his family's home, they kicked him out when he was like 16 or something like that. And he went down the street to a house that was under construction and just moved into it. And he had no problem with that at all. He has no problem living on the street at all. It's interesting when you find somebody like that and you realize that they're comfortable. It's not like they're suffering. You know, they've learned how to live like that. Well, by the time he got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, he had never had an apartment. He was living in a car down by the beach. And, you know, he needed some extra room, so he went and got another car and parked it next to it. He had a job. And, you know, for a long time, he would tell these great stories, you know. I mean, just great homeless stories. And he was sleeping in a park in Victory Park, and he'd be drinking, and he would always save some at the bottom of the bottle, an inch or so for breakfast, you know. And he felt secure that there was still some left in that bottle. He could sleep okay because he knew that if he woke up, he'd have something to drink, and you know, he'd have more medication. And he woke up and there were ants all over him. And he goes, why are there ants on me? I'm not dead. And that was his reaction to it. You know, and he's like, you know, and I really was intrigued by this guy. He was coming to AA. It was on Thanksgiving, and he went to the gratitude retreat figuring that he could get some food. And he knew what time all the hamburger places and stuff like that throw out their breakfast. And he would be by the dumpsters, and he'd get that out of the dumpster. Well, this is Thanksgiving, so he figured he'd go to the gratitude retreat because he'd gone there before, and they'd always given him some food and maybe let him sleep on the couch, you know. And he goes there, and the guy brings him in, puts him on the couch, gives him some food, and he just stayed there. Nobody told him to leave, so he just stayed there. And this guy, Paul Ragone, who's a plumber in AA, would go down to the gratitude retreat when he needed some guys to dig a ditch or something to lay pipe. He'd say, anybody want to earn a few bucks? So he tells Owen, you know, you want to earn a few bucks? Owen goes, yeah. So Owen goes with him. Owen became a plumber, you know. And he just never drank again. He just stopped. And I'd look at him, and he would tell me this, and I'd look at him, and I'd go, don't you think that's remarkable? And you think about it, you go, no. I mean, this guy's a gutter drunk. I mean, like, just like you envision, like when you see in the movies. This is this guy walking down the street talking to himself, you know. I used to drive around with him. We'd be going somewhere, and he'd see a homeless guy, and he knew all these guys. And he'd yell at him and cuss at him, and go, "Get a job, you son of a..." You know, oh, and I mean, he wasn't, like, friendly to them, you know. It's like, that guy's a loser. No shit, you know. It's like, and so I started pursuing him. He was coming to our Monday night meeting, and he didn't have a sponsor. And he would take a birthday cake and tell everybody how he was not working the steps. He was, you know, because we all in there talking about working the steps. Owen, whenever he'd share, would be sure that we understood that he's not working the steps and that he's perfectly fine. Thank you, you know. And then he would tell these crazy stories. And I just love the guy. I just thought, this guy's a jewel. He's a gem, you know. So I start pursuing him. And I said, you know, you need to do an inventory. And he goes, well, I've written some stuff down. I said, well, come on over. Let's read it, you know. So he comes over to my place, and he reads me his inventory. And it's, you know, it's a mess. He's no columns and nothing. You know, he just wrote out some stuff and confessed some horrible sins, and which didn't seem to disturb him in the least. He just, I guess this is what they want to hear about. You know, I mean, he's almost emotionless. He's an interesting guy. And he gets done, and I go, great, now let's start over. He goes, what? And I go, we're going to read the book. You and I are going to read this book together, starting from the first page. And he did. And we started working the steps, and he did another inventory. I told him, I had to tell him things like, Owen, bathe. he goes, really? Why? It was like that. I mean, it's like a true answer. Like, really? Why? What difference does that make? You smell. You know, when you walk in the house, you know, it's pretty odorous, you know? So bathe. He goes, okay. And he'd bathe. It's like, they're like, here? Okay. You know, it's like, and he was compliant. You know, he listened to me. He comes over to my garage. I'm working in the garage one day, and he says, how do you ask a girl out on a date? I go, really? You know, like, what do you do? How do you do that? And this is a 30-year-old man, you know. And I said, well, you ask her, would you like to go see a movie? He says, so they actually do that? You take them and get them something to eat and go see a movie and stuff? And I went, yeah. And he goes, well, don't they know that you just want to have sex with them?
Yes.
I mean, why bother with, why just walk up and say, hey, you want to do it? And I said, yes, Owen, they know. And we just don't say it out loud. We pretend like we want to know them better. And then if we're lucky, they'll let us have sex with them, you know. And he listened to me, like, real serious. He wasn't lying. He goes, oh, okay. You know, okay. So he would come down to my office and read the book with me and stuff. And I had a secretary there. And he asks my secretary out. And this guy has got surgeries. He had surgeries. He's a hair lip. And he's got a big scar here. He's always got about 7 or 8 days growth of beard. Not like 2 or 3. It's always, you know, he looks bad. He never combs his hair. And she said, okay. Look at that, you know, like, what? You know? So she comes back that weekend. They had this date. She comes back and she comes in my office and she's cracking up, you know. And she goes, I said, God, what happened? You know, tell me what happened. She goes, we're walking down the street and he says to me, he says, well, you want to bone down? Just like that. And she goes, no, not right now. You know, it's like, and he goes, huh. You know, and the rest of the time, he just kind of put in his time. Because he's waiting. You know, it's like, he's waiting. They end up getting married and having a kid. The guy knocked up my secretary.
Yeah, yeah, that's that's that was a great call when he called me with that one.
He knocked up my secretary. I've never felt about her the same. You know, never.
Are they still married?
No, not now. But they were married for a long time. Yeah. They it wasn't that long ago they finally split up. She finally, you know.
I would, it just, and he used to get pissed. He'd say, I came here and worked the steps. Now I got all these responsibilities.
Yeah.
It was Bill's fault.
He drifts away from AA, right? He just kind of disappeared over some time. He just stopped going to meetings completely. And then he'd come back every year and take a cake. And I'm not going to AA, and I'm okay. You know, it's like, you know, you don't have to go to AA. It's okay. I'm okay. You know, and in his own words, he would say that kind of thing. So I went up to him one time, and he never has me give him a cake after I saved his life.
And gave him a secretary.
Yeah, I gave him my secretary, and so he'd have Al, Big Al, would give him a cake. I mean, it's just absolutely hate. You see Owen show up, you go, oh God. And I walked up to him one night and I said, don't you miss us? Because he was really part of what was going on. And he looked at me and he goes, no. You know, I think he's kind of autistic or something. You know, I was like, he just doesn't have any emotions. He doesn't, he's not connecting and it's kind of okay with him, you know. And I watched the steps in the program work in this man's life. And he was literally clueless about any of it. He was not having spiritual awakenings. He wasn't, his dialogue never changed. He never came to me and he goes, you know what happened the other day? You know, I'm just filled with it. You know, it's like, not, never, never. And I would try to draw that out of him. And it worked anyway, anyway. Even though he was almost unaffected by any of it. He made amends. He made some gnarly amends. There was some real ugly stuff in his past. And he made amends. He went around. He actually did it. He got on an airplane and flew to Florida and made amends to one of his sisters. I mean, he really, I would give him those directions and he would just like a good soldier. And he'd go do it. You know, he just did it. He went back to college and got his, you know, heating and air conditioning degree up in San Francisco and put his own business together. His life got bigger. His life got larger, you know. And he's still sober to this day. He's got to be like 25 years sober, 24, something like that, you know. And he's crazy. He's just crazy. You know, he's still kind of homeless. You know, he's got that air about him where he's not part of what's going on. This guy, Al, that I talked about, where I went in with his mother, when his mother was dying, recently, he passed away a couple of weeks ago. And next Saturday, we're going to have a memorial for him at my house. And he'll have been sober 30 years. He's my longest sponsee. And I told you how much I learned from him just by watching him show up and take care of his mother and do this kind of stuff. When he was dying, I really wanted to help. And I vaguely knew his sister and his brother, and they're an incredibly dysfunctional family. I believe his father and his grandfather both killed themselves. The mother was kind of a dark, negative person, very bitter and angry. His sister, one night, he came over to my house and just banged on the front door, and it was probably 2 o'clock in the morning. And I went downstairs, and I go, you know, what's up? And what had happened is his sister and him were living in the house that their mother owned. She had long passed. And the sister, who is, if you saw her, you would, like, step around her. I mean, she's fucking nuts. I mean, you can see it in her eyes. It just comes out of her. It's like, whoa. And I always kept my distance from her. She wakes him up, spraying him with bug spray and pouring a bottle of vodka over his head. Now, Al is 6'3", 6'4". He's as big as I am, but he's larger boned. He's a big guy. He's got big calloused hands. He's a carpenter. And he woke up out of a dead sleep, and he just punched her. And he hit her and knocked her across the room up against the wall. She just slid to the floor, damn near knocked her out. And he gets up, and he runs outside and runs upstairs, and she's screaming bloody murder and calls the police. And he was going to run. And he sat there on the hood of his car, leaned up against the hood of his car, and just sat there and tried to collect himself. The police show up. They have no idea what's going on. She's screaming. There's blood running out of her eye and her lips and her nose. And, you know, he hit me. And this cop goes over to Al. This one cop walked over to him, and he looked at him. He goes, "What's going on?" And Al says, "My name's Al Wooldridge, and I'm 5-6 years sober. I'm in AA. I'm sober. It was like name, rank, and serial number. You know, just like that. And the cop looks at him. He goes, "Do you have a sponsor?" And he goes, "Yes." He goes, "Go there now and let him go." Al has no idea who that cop was, and he knows everybody. He's lived there all of his life. And he has no idea. He's never seen that guy since. He has no idea who he was. But he clearly knew some stuff, you know. And it was, I think this man, whoever he was, sensed that there was just some crazy crap going on. Nobody really got attacked, you know, and he let him go. So he comes over to my house, and he's freaked out. You know, I mean, he's totally freaked out. I sit him down. We talk for a while. Then in the morning, we get up, and I didn't know really what to do with him, so I took him to work with me. And he's sitting in my office, you know, drinking coffee and is sitting there, and we're talking. And so finally I took him and we drove over to his house. And I walk in the house and we walked into her bedroom, and she's laying in the bed, and her name's Mary Alice. And I grabbed her and I said, "Mary Alice, are you okay?" And she just kind of mumbled something, and I rolled her over. And the whole side of her face was just completely swollen up. Her eye was completely shut. It was like, whoa, man, he nailed her. And he's standing behind me crying. You know, he still couldn't figure out what the hell happened. We never were able to figure out what was going on with her when she did that. Fast forward to like a month and a half ago. I decide I'm going to try to really help them. I mean, he had some insurance issues, and he had, you know, nobody. I didn't think that anybody was going to take charge of taking care of him, because I figured she was completely incapable of it, you know. And so I walk into this situation. At one point, I'm in the hospital room, and the brother and sister, Mary Alice and his brother, are fighting with each other. These two people had not spoken in 7 years. This drew them together, the dying of their sibling. And I yelled across the room, I said, "Stop fighting!" And they both stopped. And I became daddy. It was just weird, you know? I mean, But once that happened, I figured I could just order them around. You know? And that worked for a while. It actually worked for a while. And then I started having altercations with her. So I got my wife involved. And I figured, women, you know? And she was a legal secretary for years, and we were trying to put together the power of attorney and, you know, move stuff and kind of shelter the house that he had from this. So we're over there, and we had Karen had put all this stuff together, and she starts arguing with us. And I'm sitting there. I'm sitting here. Karen's over here. Mary Alice is standing here. She won't sit down because she's just, she has a beard. I swear to God, you know, it's like, it's, she's creepy. And big glasses, you know, really, just, you walk in and you go, you just like, you know, and she's looking at me and she starts arguing with me, and I'm trying to deal with her. You know, I don't want to fight with her. I want her to just do what needs to be done. And she's got this different plan, and she's reading all this stuff. She's paranoid. Karen leans over and looks at her, and she goes, "You're awful. You're just awful." And I'm sitting there going, "Well, it's not me. It's usually me." You know, and I'm looking at Karen like, "What are you doing?" And I just got her out of the room, you know. And the reason I'm telling you this is I believe there's no limitations on how far we go in to people's lives. I don't want to be a psychotic participant in your drama, you know, but I'd known this man for 30 years. Relationships change. It's easy for me to maintain the sponsor-sponsee relationship because I know my role. And you'll hear that from a lot of people. Like, I'm just your sponsor. I'm not here to, you know, there's limitations on what I'll do. My experience is, as Jay likes to say, when my heart breaks, it breaks open. It allows more room. And I've been over the years more and more willing to get more intimately involved in what's going on with people that I've been working with. Some years ago, I started doing little fifth steps with a few of the guys that I sponsor. I did one with Matthew because I want to break down that hierarchical thing, because we're not just sponsee anymore. That isn't what the relationship is. You know, we're bound together in a very spiritual way. It's very real. And with my friend Al, I'm sitting next to him one day, and he was slowly stopping talking. He wasn't talking much anymore. I walked in the room, and he had the phone up to his ear. And after a while, I said, "Who are you talking to?" And he goes, "I don't know." And I picked up the phone, and nobody was on the other end. And it just kind of broke my heart. You know, I mean, it just, you know, he didn't know what to do. He was confused, you know. And so what do you do? You know what you do? You just lean down and you put your arms around him and you just kiss him on the head and tell him he's okay. Because he's like a little boy. Just a little boy. When his sister and brother would fight, you could see him get disturbed. That's the problem he had, was the two of them. He didn't want to see that. He'd seen it all of his life. And he didn't want to see that. And I told both of them that. I go, "Do you see what happens to him when you guys fight like this?" And she's completely oblivious. The brother kind of got it a little bit, but he's so full of rage and anger. And it's an alcoholic home, you know. Emotions are all screwed up. Sometimes we can insert ourselves into that, and we can help. We can bring some light into the darkness. But you have to pay attention a little bit, you know. It's not about, it's like, when we had that fight with Mary Alice, I just pulled away from it. I go, "I can't do this. I'm not helping anymore with this legal stuff. Let her handle it. She wants to handle it, let her go." And but I could be there for him and just hold his hand and it's going to be okay. He looked up at me one time and he says, you know, you've always been a stand-up guy. And I said, so have you, dude. So have you. And he's a weird dude. He's a very strange man. You know, he calls himself Floyd for no apparent good reason. Everybody in AA, his sister was yelling at me on the phone one time. She goes, why do they call him Floyd? Why are they calling him Floyd? His name is Al. It's Floyd. I go, no, no, Mary Alice. He's Floyd. That's just been within the last 2 or 3 years, right, because of the brain tumor. I said, no, for the last 30 years, Mary Alice, he's been whacked out for a long, long time, you know. You know, she just didn't understand that. And I think she was completely shaken up and shocked by the amount of love that was walking in that room, the number of people that came to see him right up till the end. He knew everybody. He'd walk his dog along the beach and talk to perfect strangers. You know, a month later, they're just best friends. You know, Al was like that. He's the kind of guy, and you didn't hear much about this. He'd drive down the street, and he'd see an old lady pushing a shopping cart with groceries in it. And she had just left the supermarket, and she didn't have a car, and she probably lives alone. He pulled over, stopped, would engage her in conversation, and he would do it in such a way where this woman who did not know him at all would trust him and load her groceries into his car, get in his car. He would drive her home and then unload the groceries for her. Just because, you know. And every once in a while, he would tell me one of these things. He would, you know, he didn't go broadcast it, you know. He just would do stuff like that, you know. And so how weird was he, really, in the end? You know, my sponsees are crazy? Of course they are. You know, he came from a crazy place, you know. He's at peace now. You know, he's at peace now. And I feel really good him knowing right up to the end that I was there. You know, when I first started speaking at meetings, he went with me every time. He would just go with me, you know. And he never, ever, ever, not one time did he ever say to me, that was a great talk, Bill. You know, he would just go, yeah. And then the next time he goes, where are you going now? Where are we going? And he would just go. You know, social skills, limited. You know, he even had an alias. You know, so, I mean, all three of us could sit here and regale you all day with these stories of these people that we've gotten involved in. You know, the guy with the dying kid and being involved in that, you know, and being afraid. And he went with me in there, and at the end, I wasn't afraid anymore. You know, was it hard? Was it difficult? Yeah, some of it's difficult. Some of it's very painful. You know, a lot of it doesn't have a happy ending. You know, you get close to people, and they disappear. You get close to people sometimes, and they turn on you for some reason. They'll turn on you, you know, and just get all pissed at you. Start bad-mouthing you, and it comes back around, you know. It's like, you ever heard somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous say, be careful what you share in meetings because it'll get around? Absolutely. You know, nobody keeps a goddamn secret around here, you know. I mean, I've just gotten to the point I don't give a shit what you know about me. And if you want to make up stuff about me, it's always interesting when it comes back around. I've gotten 2 or 3 phone calls in the last 6 months of people checking because they heard I was dead. You know? No. Not dead. Kind of screwed up, but I'm not dead. You know, it's like, just, who cares? It's AA. Who cares what people know? Who cares? You know, if you don't want people to know anything, don't share about it in meetings. You know, that's not what they're for. You know, don't share about it. You know, but that's enough out of me. Thank you.
J alcoholic.
Yeah.
So I think what I want to talk about a little bit is my sponsee's nuts. So I'm sober an incomprehensible amount of time. 36 years. I mean, it's just like
after you get up over about 20, it's like, I mean, it's intellectually indefensible, you know. Somebody goes, why do you go to meetings? I don't go to jail when I don't go to meetings. But it's, I mean, even then, they can't build the bridge. But how do you, or how, not how do you, how have I survived in Alcoholics Anonymous as I've gotten more and more time? Because, see, when I came into AA, there was nobody with 20 years regularly attending any of the meetings that I went to. They would occasionally stop by. But there wasn't even, I mean, Rashid was the only guy that had any time. I mean, he had 18 years. So there's no Eric Bloor had like 15, you know? I mean, these people, and I mean, that was forever. But there was no, so what do you do? What do you do? And so there's a couple things that I'd like to share with you that are absolutely heretical to how I lived my first 25 years in the fellowship. But I think that it's really important that Alcoholics Anonymous, as I know it, gets to pass from the scene. And that Alcoholics Anonymous, as you know it, gets to be what's going on. And it's more important for me to support your spiritual evolution than it is for me to try and get you to see how AA was or how things were when I was getting sober or the Alcoholics Anonymous that was given to me. Now, I'm not talking about the principles. I'm not talking about the steps, because that's what we've been talking about the whole time. But I want to talk about relationships. I want to talk about how to survive in meetings and how to survive with friendships. I think Bill Cleveland stopped calling me in about 1988. Truly. And I spent about 10 years, you know, waiting for him to come around and, you know, come back to the fold. And
I was,
you know,
busy. I was busy.
Well, yeah, he was busy, and his sponsoring himself was highly entertaining. And but the thing is that the truth of the matter is that I love this man very, very much, and I admire him, and I admire the work that he's doing in AA more than I care about what my role is to be in his life. And so when he got on interferon, which was what?
10 or 12 years ago.
Yeah.
15,
yeah, it was a long time ago. I knew that from just being around AA and all that stuff and people being on interferon, and I knew that it was going to be emotionally taxing for him, and he was already emotionally taxed because he's a very sensitive guy. But I knew that expecting him to call me was just ridiculous. So I started calling him. And I've called him at least once a week for the past 15 years. Now, unfortunately, because people have observed this a bit, they actually sometimes say that he sponsors me or that we co-sponsor each other. Nothing is further from the truth. Please, I have always had a sponsor that I can go to for some solid direction. But because I love and admire the man, and it's up to me, is it more important for me to be in a role, or is it more important to have a relationship? And the only way that I've found for us to have a relationship that's current and that works is for me to call him. It's the same thing with Matthew. although Matthew occasionally calls me to complain about his sponsor, but we talk about all kinds of we share a couple outside interests that are fun that are not guitar based, but I love and admire this man, and I want a relationship with him, and so I have no problem at all in calling him, especially when things are going south in my life, and not especially when that's not true. I will tell him the difference, because we both have wives that have had profound challenges. So the Alcoholics Anonymous that I treasure is non-hierarchical, and that what we do collectively is more important than a top-down thing. Now, that's not to say that, you know, when you're 6 years sober, that you don't just bang the hell out of them and get in their face and, you know, work the steps or die and all that. I mean, but I'm talking about surviving in a tribal atmosphere. See, the thing here in Alcoholics Anonymous that we have is we have tribal wisdom that we can share. And it's not just from the elders down. And Bill Wilson was very, very clear about that the problem with elders in Alcoholics Anonymous is they think they know something and they want to control things. And that power just naturally gravitates toward. And how do we create a mechanism where that doesn't? So I want to show, this is my experience, strength, and hope for you, is that that it is possible for the roles to morph and to become... I will always be this man's sponsor, at least until he fires me next week. but
I kind of like you right now.
Yeah, well, because I'm talking about you.
I walked into that one.
Why did you shoot me? Well, you handed the gun and you said. But anyway, the thing is that. So there's that. The other thing is that, so this is one of the dearest relationships in my life. This is how it's changed. Now, how does that change within the matter of the home group? We're going out to hear Bill talk at Stateline. It was a big deal for all of us when Bill got to go and talk at this particular convention. And we were driving out there, and I found a couple of tapes from one of the Anonymous programs that was called Family Anonymous. And we found tapes of his parents talking about their horrible family situation. And it was wild.
It was creepy.
It was creepy. They're both dead, you know, and we both loved it. But anyway, it was... And while I was there at this thing, I had this experience where I realized that I was 25 years sober and that I was more interested in making sure that what it was that was happening in my groups was as I remembered it, instead of allowing the groups to flower and change. And so I, who was very instrumental in the group inventories and all that, I decided on the drive back, I said, I'm going to stop going to the business meetings. Because I can change the business meeting just by the way I sit, by the way I look. I didn't scowl really. I got a great rat face, Alan, on look. So I quit doing that because I trust the evolution of the collective more than my wanting things to be the way that I want them to be. And I trust, you know, the people that put on this event and their spiritual evolution more than I want to trust my memory. And I want to support and create an environment where they can thrive more than I want to be acknowledged. I want to do that. And, you know, how do I do that? You know, with stuff like this. But I want you to know that it's been a very, very interesting thing. So then I, too, get this weird call to move to Sedona. Now, I was never going to leave the Hermosa Beach men's stag. They were going to cremate me and put me in the mop bucket and swab the floor of the Alano Club just so that I'd always be there Monday night.
I might still do that.
Yeah. I'm sure Adele would be happy to share. But anyway, and I sponsor, I sponsored some tremendous, tremendous people. And went to just some fabulous meetings. And it was, I never thought that I'd leave them. And yet I got the inspiration. I got called. I mean, the voice said to me literally, move here now. You know, and the nice thing about being older and underemployed was I could do that. And I did. And I land in Sedona. Now, I've been active in Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles. And I moved to a town of 10,000 people. I was a little worried, you know. But fortunately, the mean age in the city is 48 years old. My wife said if I would have tried to bring her there 5 years earlier, she would have had to shoot me because there's just too many old people in the town. And I found an Alcoholics Anonymous experience that was fabulous because in this neighborhood that we're talking about and that I was involved in, I'd seen literally almost everyone get sober. So the position that I had in the meeting was not one that I wanted, but just always one that people will react. Who does he think he is? Why is he acting that way? You know, and I moved to a place, and now I'm just a member. They don't care who JS is, or they don't care. And it's been the most lovely thing. It's been the most lovely thing for me because I get to just be an AA member, and I was there about 6 months, and a guy asked me to sponsor him. And there was another couple, and got the critical mass. We got the first little book study done, and did that. You know, they're all odd about this California sponsorship and all that. And I did the same thing that Matthew did. I started going to the jail. I've been going for a while now, and the county jail, and it's been a wonderful experience for me to go there. And this is nothing new. Everybody that I know that's successful in moving in Alcoholics Anonymous, what they had to do was not rely upon the meetings, but to get involved in one of the service structures. H&I usually the easiest one, because when you get involved in H&I, some of the times you have a panel and you were actually able to bring people with you so you could invite people to come. In the county jails, you can't do that. You know, you're just, you got a couple guys and that's it. But it's been a remarkable experience for me because I really get to feel AA. And I get to see my face in those orange jumpsuits. And I get to see them in their green suits when they're getting ready to get out. All you have to do is ask whatever is to please send you a drunk. That's all you have to do. And then go to the meeting remembering that that's the prayer that you said. And when you walk in the door, look around, and if there's somebody that you haven't met yet, walk up and say, "Hi, I'm Jay. I'm Mary. I come to this meeting regularly, and I haven't had the pleasure of meeting you before. Do you have a seat? Are you visiting?" Instead of, "Are you new?" There's a great book that Dr. Bob used to give everybody that he sponsored called The Greatest Thing in the World by Henry Drummond. This is before they had the big book, and I'm sure even after. And he'd have them read it, and then they had to come back and talk to him about it. And at the end of it, Drummond is talking, and he says, and this is my experience. He says that I have seen almost every beautiful thing that there is in this world. But the real experience is in little acts. Do you have it?
No.
Well, you know what? I'm gonna look. I've got it in my thing. Now, anyway, Drummond says that where the essence of the spiritual experience is in cold sips of water given on hot days. It's not the big thing. It's the small acts of kindness. And that's what we get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what sponsorship's about. You know, it's encouraging people to walk those places where they've been afraid to walk. It's about loving them fearlessly. It's about giving them encouragement in a way that their families never could. And are they nuts? Of course, but I think that it's interesting to see the moralism that we sometimes apply on people. You know, instead of looking at ourselves and remembering how broken we were. And I guess that's probably enough out of me. Thank you.
And so, before we take our break, we just want to make a couple announcements that we're going to, just the last part of this workshop, and thank you for attending for 3 days and however long you've been able to come. We've really gotten so much out of it. But we're going to do a question and answer time. But before we do that, I thought we would honor somebody who's sitting here today. This is my sponsor, Bill. And today, Easter Sunday, everybody thinks belongs to Jesus.
But we know it
actually belongs to Bill. Bill's 31 years sober today.
You ready? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Bill. Happy birthday to you.
Now, Bill has a tattoo.
Oh, yeah.
On his arm. It describes who he is, what he was, and it's horny, but it's misspelled. It's H-O-R-N-E-A.
N-E-Y.
Horny.
Because so, between the three of them, they couldn't figure out how to spell horny.
So, three times, hip, hip, horny. Hip, hip, horny. Hip, hip, horny.
And the cake says, happy birthday, horny. So have a break and eat cake with us, okay? Yeah.